I am curious, how many of you made New Year's resolutions of some sort this year? Just out of curiosity. I know I did. Yeah, sort of. Yeah, okay. I was reading in the Post today how the vast majority of New Year's aspirations were to lose weight, like 80% of the population or 90%. But, you know, when I've taken polls several years, and I have, of course, a self-selected group that I take polls from. It's, you know, this type of a group. By far, the aspiration I hear the most is to be less judgmental, in some way kinder towards ourselves and others. That's the one I hear the most. And the follow-up one is usually to create more space to, in some way, practice, whether it's formally or informally, to come into presence. I do feel like it's a kind of a nice thing, a handy thing, to have a new year start, even though it's just a consensual idea, because there's something about stepping back and sensing the shape of our life and what matters, and feeling a little more collected around, okay, I really want to live my life true to what most matters and not get so lost in the habit of how I move through the day. And so our theme for tonight, as many of you know from the emails and so on, are called the Taking the Refuge. And the refuges in the Buddhist tradition are really pathways to presence, to remembering, really fully being here. And I'm wondering, how many of you have done a refuge ceremony with us before? Just raise your hand high. A good number. Good. Wonderful. Well, I take the refuges every day, so don't feel like been there, done that. You know, it's a powerful kind of a process. So I'll explain a bit more, but the bottom line for me is that this path is about forgetting and remembering, and that forgetting's not bad or evil. In fact, we're designed to forget. We're designed to have our attention contract and get fixated and so on. And we're designed to not only forget, but get very caught up in feeling like a small self or a bad self or insufficient or that something's wrong with our life. I mean, that's really part of our psychological conditioning and our cultural conditioning. Not enough, have to have more. So forgetting is a given. It's also a given that we have the capacity to recognize that and to reconnect with something larger, with a kind of a sincerity and longing for a freedom that we intuit and for an experience of wholeness that is really allows us to notice the small self ideas but not be hitched to them, where we can really live more from a place of awareness and love. So that's our capacity. And so we do these practices of remembering. And then as we do them, we get more, and I find that we get more and more sensitive to what it's like to get contracted and to realize that we're kind of spinning and going through time, not necessarily so awake. One of my very favorite cartoons, some of you might remember, is a picture of a graveyard. And you're seeing a thought bubble come up from underground. And the thought bubble says, I think I know what I want to do with my life. And the caption underneath, Ed pushes the late bloomer envelope to surprising new limits, you know. So rather than going through the days or the decades, you know how I think it was Joseph Campbell said that we put our ladder against the wall and climb up and realize it was up against the wrong wall, you know. So rather than spending our time chasing after the ideas of what we think are going to do it for us, now's the time. Now is the time to say, okay, so what matters? And be more aligned. So these refuges are really gateways to remembering. and the Three Refuges, and they're also known as the Triple Jewel. The first one is refuge in the Buddha, and what it really is refuge in what's called Buddha nature. Buddha nature. And that Buddha nature is really the intrinsic awakeness, that kind of radiance of awakeness and the intrinsic love that is what we are. So taking refuge in Buddha means taking refuge in really the truth of what we are, the deepest truth. Taking refuge in the Dharma, Dharma means truth or path. So we take refuge in what's real. And we take refuge in our moment-to-moment experience. And that's most of what our meditations are here, taking refuge in the Dharma. And then taking refuge in the Sangha. Sangha means spiritual community or field of relatedness. And we take refuge in the Sangha as a way to wake up to the truth of connectedness, to out of that story of separate selfness. So tonight we'll reflect on each. And then we'll together do a kind of ceremony where we're really giving ourselves to these three gateways. And I'll say in advance, it doesn't matter whether you affiliate as a Buddhist or not. These are kind of universal ways of paying attention to relationship, to presence, to the truth of what we are. You know, in Pali, which is the language of the Buddha, the word siddha is the word for faith, and the definition is resting one's heart in what is true. So, in a way, these practices are we're learning to really rest our attention in what's true. And I like to contrast taking refuge to our habit of placing our attention in what I call false refuges. And I think it's really useful for all of us to have a sense of, okay, what are the ways that I take false refuge? You know, when I get stressed, how do I try to go for something that'll comfort, but actually that ends up deepening the trance? We kind of dig our hole deeper. So in both Buddhist and Western psychology, there's a very clear understanding that when things are pleasant, we quickly try to hold on, and when they're unpleasant, we quickly resist. And we have all these elaborate strategies of going through our life trying to get pleasure or happiness in ways that don't really work, and all these strategies of resisting in ways that end up causing more trouble. So those are false refuges. And the main reason they're false refuges, whenever we're chasing after something that doesn't feel like it's right here, or whenever we're resisting, not liking what's right here, we're at war with the moment. And the present moment, what's here, is the only place that we can really experience love. So we can have an abstract sense of loving, but if we're in some way resisting what's going on right now or trying to have something different or more, we're not able to inhabit it. If we're leaving the moment, we can't really see truth. We can have ideas about, like we can have views of the world, but we can't see reality as it is in any moment that we're wanting things different, wanting more, pushing away. Those are two biggies, truth and love. And it's the same thing with creativity, real creativity. We can't be in an argument with the moment. We need to be inhabiting our fullness. Charlotte Joko Beck says, and she's a Zen teacher, return to that which we have spent a lifetime hiding from, to rest in the bodily experience of the present moment. Even if it is a feeling of being humiliated, of failing, of abandonment, of unfairness. The understanding being we all have layers of what's difficult. And if we're running away, that becomes our life habit, and we don't get to discover under those layers the freedom that's possible. So it's a powerful inquiry that I kind of invite you to explore, which is, what am I running away from in this moment? What am I hiding from? You know, what would happen if I just said yes to whatever's right here? How do I run away? How do I hide? And we all have strategies. I'll name a couple, because you know them. Our biggest one, stay busy. I mean, we distract ourselves. We're addicted to phones and computers and iPods and email. We're just addicted. These are ways of leaving the moment. It doesn't mean that we don't do those things in a way that are present and skillful at times, but they get misused and abused. So we stay busy. We're very speedy, which, as many of you know, I've described I think it's the Chinese syllable for the word busy is heart killing. It's our culture. It's that way. So that's one false refuge, this kind of addiction to busyness. And then we have an addiction to getting things done. It's not a kind of creative productivity. There's this need to be worthwhile. I have to check this off the list and this off the list. Like going through the day. We're trying to get through the day and check things off. That's leaving the moment. We have an addiction to try to hold on to pleasantness. We try to line up our experiences, whether it's pleasant sensations through food or drugs or whatever, even sleeping. You know how in India they say sleep is a poor man's nirvana. You know, I like that. And caffeine's a big one. I went to a conference on addiction, and there was this kind of big drawn-out panel with two homeless men on a park bench. And one saying to the other, I used to be a CEO of a multinational corporation, have a home in Aspen, have a private jet, and then I switched to decaf, you know. So we have these refuges of busyness and trying to grasp after things, addictions to substances, refuge in trying to prove we're good or prove we're right. We have a refuge in our addiction to thinking. Rather than being here, we get addicted to figuring things out. Have you noticed that? How many moments you're on your way somewhere else and trying to figure something out? That's a false refuge. I know one of the yogis, the students from this retreat we just had, we had a New Year's retreat, was describing how she felt like she was going through life trying to outwit aging and outwit sickness and the realization you can't. But we take a false refuge in trying to control or be clever. One of my favorite stories, and I shared this with some of you, I think, last year, because it's a poodle story, and I have poodles. A wealthy man went on a safari in Africa and decided to take his beloved pet poodle along for company. One day, the poodle started chasing some butterflies and found himself totally lost. Wandering about, he saw a leopard rapidly heading his way, and he thought to himself, uh-oh. Luckily, the poodle noticed some bones on the ground close by and immediately turned his back to the approaching cat and started to chew on them. Just as the leopard was about to pounce, the poodle called out, boy, that was one delicious leopard, but I'm still hungry. I wonder if there's another one around. Upon hearing this, the leopard halted his attack in mid-stride, a look of abject terror on his face. He crawled off into some nearby tree, thinking, boy, that was a close call. That creature nearly got me. Meanwhile, a monkey had been watching this whole scene from high in a nearby tree. The monkey called out to the leopard, promising some valuable information in return for the leopard's protection. The leopard agreed to the deal and, of course, was furious to learn that he had just been made a fool of. The leopard, now with the monkey on his back, took off to find and eat the conniving canine. Once again, the poodle saw the leopard, this time with a monkey in its back, approaching. He put two and two together while realizing he wouldn't have time to escape. So he sat down with his back to his attackers, pretending he hadn't seen them. And just when they got close enough to hear, he exclaimed, "Where is that damn monkey? I sent him off an hour ago to bring me another leopard." False refuge in our cleverness. We are trying to manipulate. We take refuge in judgment, in blaming. How many moments have we spent really resentful, blaming, angry towards others or ourselves as a way not to feel the vulnerability that's right here? How many moments? And how much of the war on this globe can we see as trying to leave anxiety and take refuge in attacking others? We take refuge in our stories about ourselves. We would rather think bad things about ourselves than be right here. Now, isn't that strange? You know how we tell ourselves all this inner dialogue? What's wrong? What's going to go wrong? How we're falling short? We'd rather do that because it gives us some sense of familiarity, orientation, like we can maybe fix it then. But we take false refuge in it to try to have a sense of control rather than opening to this mysterious experience of here, where we're not controlling, but rather we're living this life. We keep taking false refuge. So it sustains the trance. Every time we leave in our stories, we leave in our judgments, in trying to have some more food or get online when we don't really need to, we're leaving what's here. We're fueling that trance that keeps us in some way separate and disconnected, not at home. So taking true refuge, resting in what we really can trust, we'll go through the three of them, and I'm going to switch the order and start with refuge in Dharma, which really means refuge. The first refuge is really that I want to talk about is the one we practice here, which is paying attention to what's actually going on, senses awake. I've shared with you one of my favorite verses from Ryokan, the Zen poet, and I'll just say it again because it's a beautiful one to just kind of drop in and sense. If you want to know the Buddhist law, drift east, drift west, come and go, entrusting yourself to the waves. Entrusting yourself to the waves. So this first refuge, entrusting ourselves to the waves, doesn't mean that we trust that we're not going to die. And I'm saying that on purpose because it's not this promise like if you just let go, then this body will live forever, or you'll never be unhappy or fearful. But rather, the promise in this refuge, if we entrust ourselves to the waves, we discover the presence that really is the ocean. We discover that what we are is that vastness. And as one of my favorite kind of expressions, if you can trust you're the ocean, you're not afraid of the waves. You can include them, but you're not at war. So the first refuge is presence, is this practice of presence. It's learning to stay. It's pausing and saying, okay, what's happening right here? And listening, and feeling your breath, and feeling your heart, and maybe feeling what is vulnerable or anxious, or feeling off balance, and not leaving that. Just staying. And sometimes it's intense. There's some sort of anguish or real discomfort. And one of the mantras, you know, there's several mantras that help us stay with that. Ajahn Sumedho, who is an American monk who teaches in Great Britain, says that when it's difficult to say, just, it's like this, it's like this. And to really kind of commit the attention to just this. It's gentle, but it's just honest. It's like this right now. And there's something in being able to acknowledge, okay, it hurts. That in the moment of recognizing, we become the one that's recognizing, not the small self at war. It's like this. Or we can say, it's okay. It's kind of like, it's painful, but it's okay. It's one of the waves. Or I like to say this too. You know, that whatever it is, you can say this too, that there's room for this too. Because ultimately, we're not free if we can't say this too. So many people, when they watch themselves, realize they're tensing against what's around the corner, as if life is about to take a turn and there's going to be something intolerable or too much. So it's like we're tensing against what's up and coming. This too. Just sense if you can say, this too, or for me, perhaps one of the most liberating is just yes. Not yes, I like this or I want more of this. But yes, I mean, what happens when right now you just say yes to whatever is right here? Without any resistance. Yes to these sounds. There's an openness. Yes to the sensations. However it is, it's like this. There are times in our life where the drama or injury feels so great. It's like, how can we do that? And that's why we practice. We practice to begin to trust and have access to the heart and awareness that really has room for life and death in all its expressions. And the deepest happiness is not getting the pleasure that we want in any moment. The deepest happiness is that kind of confidence that we are that space and that awareness and love that has room for this life. We don't have to tense against the future. We can live this life. And that's what we long for, to live fully. One friend several years ago, she was going through a divorce and there were wave after wave of grief and anger and kept flipping back and forth how he was wrong and then how she was wrong and how she should have seen the flags and so on. And she knew the practice to keep trying to drop the stories and be with, stay with, all that, you know, roiling. It was anguish. And she was using the Ajahn Sumedho phrase. She kept saying, okay, it's like this. And she did a lot of what we do here sometimes, the hand on her heart where she was feeling ripped up, really. She felt like a knife was just ripping, tearing, slicing. And any thought that she had was dukkha, was suffering. It got very clear, any thought, what she could do differently, what he should have done, what she's going to do next, any judgment, anything was a false refuge. She got it. And so she just kind of started nailing her attention to this moment, breathing with the worst feelings, the things she most wanted to run away from. And it took time. She ended up feeling like she was breathing with pure, raw shame. That was what it seemed to come down to. It was shame and this core sense of I'm unlovable. And when she could stay long enough with that, just breathing with it, it's like this, she found this kind of exquisite tenderness that was holding that. It was like by being with it, she realized she was beginning to hold that shame. And that was when things started shifting. That's when she took refuge in the Dharma. And she entrusted herself to the waves and started feeling this kind of ocean of compassion. Those weren't her words, but that was what happened. I've seen it again and again, just this last week at our New Year's retreat, and I know I'm seeing a lot of you that were there. I would do interviews, and it was just amazing to see as the days went by that as everyone was taking refuge more and more and just noticing and being with, there was this kind of sense of opening and sensing a shift in who I am. Not at war, but on this presence. And then seeing what the other part of Dharma means is the truth, which is everything changes. These waves keep changing. And the truth that if we're resisting anything, we're going to stay stuck. What we resist persists is the little, you know. Seeing the truth that when we're really present, the pain becomes less personal. It becomes a wave in our ocean. And it's not so much just our pain. We sense that everyone's struggling with this. There's some freedom. So we'll just take a moment to do a reflection together on refuge in the Dharma and then take what's next. This is short. Just to invite you to sit. We're going to do the ceremony at the end, but it builds on these three reflections we're doing right now. So just to feel yourself, your attention going inward. And let your senses be awake. And your intention to just relax with what is. Feeling what's here with an intimate attention, this breath, sounds, sensing the space that's here. Sensing what it means to stay. A soft, allowing attention. It's like this. Trust the energy that courses through you. Trust and take surrender even deeper. Be the energy. This is a poem by Dana Faltz. Trust the energy that courses through you. Trust, then take surrender even deeper. Be the energy. Don't push anything away. Follow each sensation back to its source. In vastness and pure presence. Emerge so new, so fresh, that you don't know who you are. Welcome in the season of monsoons. Be the bridge across the flooded river and the surging torrent underneath. Be unafraid of consummate wonder. Be the energy and blaze a trail across the clear night sky like lightning. Dare to be your own illumination. That's refuge in the Dharma. There, when the Buddha talked about refuge in the Sangha, which is spiritual community, initially it was refuge in the community of monks and nuns, and of course that's enlarged We can consider Sangha, all our spiritual friends, those that are intentional about waking up. And in the broadest sense, really, Sangha is the whole field of relationship, all beings that we belong to. So false refuge is when we really start, through our inner dialogue and our actions, we're just revving up a self that feels worse than or better than, but either way, separate. And refuge in Sangha wakes us up to the truth of non-separation. It's very easy to get into practicing on the cushion and having some idea that I'm a self that's going to get liberated, you know, and really working hard on polishing our style and meditation. And in some way, it reinforces a sense of separation, of selfing that is actually painful. So to take refuge in the Sangha means we discover we have the same shared vulnerabilities, and we're really waking up to that shared sense of presence and awareness. So we wake up with our family, with our friends, with our spiritual friends. The Sangha here in Washington, just to say, the Insight Meditation community, I've seen in different domains how rich it is for people that really kind of give themselves to certain ways of getting to know each other, like the Kalyana Mitta groups. Some of you are part of, how many are in a KM group? Can I just see by hand? Yeah. They meet every other week, and it's a place in a small group. It's more intimate than this, just to explore how to wake up in the midst of everything. So that's a way that Sangha happens. I see it in retreats. We had our closing circle 2 days ago with 70 people in it, and here we had been silent for 5 days, and yet there had been this respect and friendliness in the silence and a sense of growing connection. And then with the speaking, I mean, one person said, you know, I'm in love with everyone here. And another, this is my chosen family. And I've heard so many a sense of, you know, I just feel kind of homecoming because we're really dedicated to the same heart awakening. I see it growing amongst those that in some way are volunteering, because you get to, that's the way I get to mainly know people, is those that are, you know, volunteering or serving the Sangha, the organization, whether it's, you know, managing retreats or the board or board committees. And we'll let you know more about that. But there are many ways to deepen your sense of Sangha and involvement with this particular community. But I'd like to speak more broadly, that to take refuge in Sangha means that there's an intention to slow down, deepen our attention, and see who's here. When we have an intention to be awake with each other, we become able to be an ocean for each other when we're caught in vulnerability, and to remind each other of our goodness. There's a story, again, I shared it several years ago, that I found again, and I just wanted to bring it in tonight. And it's written by a sister, Helen Rosa, and it really has to do with community. She writes, "He was in the first third grade class I taught at St. Mary's. All 34 students are dear, but Mark was one in a million. Mark talked incessantly. I had to remind him again and again that talking without permission was not acceptable. What impressed me was his sincere response. 'Thank you for correcting me, sister.' I didn't know what to make of it at first, but after a while I became accustomed to hearing it many times a day. One morning, my patient was growing thin when Mark talked too often. I made a novice teacher's mistake. I looked at him and said, 'If you say one more word, I'm going to tape your mouth shut.' It wasn't 10 seconds later when Chuck blurted out, 'Mark's talking again.' Now, I hadn't asked students to help me watch, but I had to act on what I said. I walked to my desk, pulled out a roll of masking tape, and without saying a word, I proceeded to Mark's desk, tore off the paste, pieces of tape, made a big X over his mouth. I returned in front of the room, and as I glanced at Mark, he winked at me. That did it. I started laughing. The class cheered, and I walked back to his desk, removed the tape. His first words were, "Thank you for correcting me, sister." At the end of the year, I asked to teach junior high math. The years flew by, and before I knew it, Mark and his group were in my class again. Since he had to listen to my instructions carefully in new math, he didn't talk quite as much in ninth as he had in third. One Friday, things didn't feel just right. We had worked hard on a new concept all week, and I sensed that the students were frustrated with themselves and edgy with one another. I had to stop this crankiness before it got out of hand. So I asked them to list the names of the other students in the room on two sheets of paper, leaving a space between each name. I told them to think of the nicest thing they could say about each of their classmates and write it down. It took the remainder of the class period to finish their assignment, and then they handed me their papers. That Saturday, I wrote down the name of each student on a separate sheet of paper, and I listed what everyone had said about that individual. And on Monday, I gave each student his list, or her list. Before long, the entire class was smiling. "Really," I heard whispered, "I never knew that meant anything to anyone. I didn't know people liked me so much." Your smile, blue eyes, the way you listen, your friendliness. No one ever mentioned these papers in class again. I never knew if they discussed them with each other or their parents. It didn't matter. The exercise accomplished purpose. The students were happy with themselves and each other again. That group of students moved on. Several years later, after I returned from vacation, my parents met me at the airport. As we were driving home, Mother asked me the usual questions. My father was silent. Then he said, "Mark's family called last night." "Really? I haven't heard from them for years. How's Mark?" Dad responded quietly, "Mark was killed in Vietnam. The funeral's tomorrow, and his parents would like it if you could attend." I had never seen a serviceman in a military coffin before. Mark looked so handsome, so mature. All I could think at that moment was, "Mark, I would give all the masking tape in the world if only you would talk to me." As I stood there, one of the soldiers came up to me. "Were you Mark's math teacher?" he asked. I nodded as I continued to stare at the coffin. "Mark talked about you a lot," he said. After the funeral, most of Mark's former classmates headed to Chuck's farmhouse for lunch. Mark's mother and father were there, obviously waiting for me. "We want to show you something," his father said, taking a wallet out of his pocket. "They found this on Mark when he was killed. We thought you might recognize it." Opening the billfold, he carefully removed two worn pieces of notebook paper that had been obviously taped, folded, and refolded many times. I knew without looking that the papers were the ones on which I had listed all the good things each of Mark's classmates had said about him. "Thank you so much for doing that," Mark's mother said. "As you can see, Mark treasured it." Mark's classmates started to gather around us. Charlie smiled rather sheepishly and said, "I still have my list. It's in the top drawer of my desk at home." Chuck's wife said, "Chuck asked me to put his in our wedding album." "I have mine too," Marilyn said. "It's in my diary." Then Vicky, another classmate, reached into her pocket and took out her wallet and shone it right there, worn and frazzled. "I carry it with me all the time. I think we all saved our lists." That's when I finally sat down and cried. I cried for Mark and for all his friends who had never seen him, again. Cried about the wonder of caring and the preciousness of expressing it. So there are many ways of taking refuge in Sangha, actively and prayerfully. The bottom line is any reflection that we do or any behavior that allows us to feel sincerely the truth of our connection. As in this story, one of the most beautiful is when we, you know, that namaste, "I see the divine in you." When we can in some way look at another and in some way communicate, "I see that goodness." Because it helps bring it out and it helps others trust themselves, which is really what frees us. So we'll do a reflection on Sangha, if you will, just to take a few moments, close your eyes. And we'll reflect in a simple way, just to bring to mind someone who's part of your Sangha. It could be informally, formally, someone who you care about, feel belonging with. And just to keep it uncomplicated, it could be a pet. It could be someone who's no longer alive. And as you bring this being to mind, sense them right here and sense what you love about this being, their goodness. Sense the way they show their love to you, their kindness. Just sensing yourself kind of bowing to their goodness, letting them know your care, your appreciation. You might mentally whisper their name and just express your appreciation. Feel it coming from that being also to you. So that you can sense in a visceral way the field that connects you, that's here, bigger than you're thinking about them or them about you, just the field of care. And then you can bring others into that field of care. Just kind of an open heart, just sensing another person in your life, another part of your Sangha. As if you could bow to that person's goodness, their the way the divine shines through that person or being. Sense how your heart holds that person. And then just let it open wide. Just sensing your Sangha here for those you know and those you don't know right in this room, that there's a sincerity, a shared caring about being awake and real. Rumi says, if 10 lamps are present in one place, each differs in form from another, yet you can't distinguish whose radiance is whose when you focus on the light. In the field of spirit, there is no division. Sweet is the oneness of the friend with friends. Catch hold of the spirit. Help this headstrong self dissolve that beneath it you may discover unity. Like a buried treasure. Refuge in the Sangha. We take refuge in the Buddha by taking refuge in the Dharma and the Sangha. And that's not all, but just as a beginning to say that when you take refuge in the Sangha and feel that field of connection, you're discovering Buddha nature. And when you become very present with what is, you discover the presence that is our essential nature. You can also pay attention to Buddha nature by reflecting on an awakened being and just sensing the light and radiance of that being's energy, and then sensing really as you relax and open that that's what you are. And in the most deep way, you can do what the Buddha did under the Bodhi tree in the historical rendition of the Buddha's awakening, that towards the dawn, the Buddha looked into his own mind, looked into awareness itself, and sense the luminosity the love that really was the pure essence of being, and then just became that. So there are different ways that we can awaken to Buddha nature, but just for now, in a simple way, just to invite you to close your mind. You can do that too. It might help. Just as a final kind of seated meditation before our ceremony, just again to let yourself become still. And we take refuge in the Dharma just to, again, sense the waves of experience right now. You might listen. With a receptivity, just let sounds wash through you. Listening to the whole moment. And with that same receptivity, feeling the whole moment. And with some interest, just to notice who or what is aware right now. Just relax and become that awareness. The space, that sea of wakefulness. That which we seek is right here. It says, Ramakrishna says, O longing mind, dwell within the depth of your own pure nature. Do not seek your home elsewhere. Your naked awareness alone, O mind, is the inexhaustible abundance for which you long so desperately. This path is one of forgetting and remembering, getting into the trance of a small self on our way, and then pausing, taking refuge in this changing moment-to-moment experience, sensations and sounds, pausing and taking refuge in the love that's here with others. Pausing and sensing what it is we really are, taking refuge in this open, empty space of wakefulness. When we take refuge in what's true, our lives become an expression of compassion and action. We naturally respond to our world with courage and grace and care. Okay, so open your eyes, and we're just in a few moments going to stand up, actually, but I'll just ask you, is there anyone that does not have one of these red threads? Okay, so in Buddhist Asia and Hindu countries, this thread that you have is a symbol of blessing. And what it actually is a thread from the robe of a monk. And So what we're going to be doing is making a necklace or a bracelet from this thread. And what that means is that you will, in the marketplace, in daily life, you become a monk or nun in drag, you know. You kind of remember your true home in that way. And when Chogyam Trungpa, a great Tibetan teacher, was asked what these protection cords protect us against, he said, "Why, yourself, of course." And what he meant was that conditioning of the self to grasp and to resist. It helps to remind us to come back home again, to take refuge in what's true. So what we'll do is reflect on each of the refuges and then infuse the cord, the protection cord, with our own awareness. And as a way of doing this, I think I'd like to ask you to stand up, if you will. And Rose, or if there happens to be a mic that you can bring up, that'd be great, because otherwise I get to look up at everyone and not stand with you. But I'll start sitting down. What you're going to be doing is holding your cord, each end with one end with one hand, the other end with the other. That means put down your sheets. You don't need them yet. We're going to reflect on each of the refuges and then tie a knot into the cord to really sense us infusing that refuge into the cord. So you might just close your eyes and sense the refuge. I take refuge in the Buddha. And what you're meaning by that is I take refuge in Buddha nature, in my own most awake, wise, loving nature. So to reflect on this, to whisper it to yourself, I take refuge in Buddha nature, or whatever version of words resonates for you, so it's true for your heart. You might say, I take refuge in loving presence, in my own awakened heart. And once you have reflected on that and feel that sincerity, please tie your first knot into your protection cord. I take refuge in the Buddha. Okay, the second reflection. I take refuge in the Dharma. To just sense the meaning of this, that in taking refuge in the Dharma, we're giving ourselves to the path of waking up, to the practice of presence, of really committing ourselves to being here, sacred presence, and to the truths that are revealed of this changing world. Taking refuge in the Dharma is taking refuge by entrusting ourselves to the waves. So to reflect on that, and just when it feels real in you, when it feels sincere, sense that you could then give that energy and commitment to tying your next knot into the cord. The third refuge, again, you might whisper it and just feel it in your heart and mind. I take refuge in the Sangha, and that's the spiritual community, really the community of beloved ones, relationship. So we take refuge in Sangha. It's really that dedication in our heart to bring our attention to awakening love, to realizing our connection to all beings. I take refuge in the Sangha. And when that feels alive and resonant, to tie that third knot. And together as a community, what we bring in this atmosphere to really bring to life these protection cords is our shared aspiration, which is from the Bodhisattva path, that by taking refuge, by bringing our heart mind to this path in this way, that this be of benefit to all beings everywhere, that our prayers and our actions, our hearts and minds ripple out, that all beings everywhere might discover and experience the freedom of heart and mind. So just to sense that aspiration, that this might serve all beings. And then to put your cord around your neck so the ends are both on your chest, or if you'd prefer to have this cord be a bracelet, you can have it at your wrist. And then please turn to a partner, because you're going to need a partner to help you on this. If you don't have a partner, just kind of raise your hand and find someone nearby. And if there's no one nearby, just join a pair so you can be the third in a pair. What you're doing, and this is on silence, this is a ritual, is you're going to tie each other's cords. And you can do it one at a time if that's less awkward. You're going to tie each other's cords. And again, if you don't have a partner, please turn to where two people are so that one of those people can tie your cord when they're done. So this is, again, part of that we're not doing this by ourselves. We're allowing our connection with others to be part of this process. So again, if you can, on silence, just sense that you're really participating together, serving each other in this. When you're done tying each other's cords, take a moment with this namaste means I see the divine in you, just to bow, just to honor each other, sense your wish that these refuges might serve awakening. And then while you're standing up, turn around and see if you can offer that namaste to a few others in silence. Just take a few moments to kind of circulate and sense that you're really seeing this divine, this sincerity, and just namaste. Yeah, just circulate around. Okay, and then coming back to your seats and sitting down and taking your sheet. A question was asked whether if you've done this ceremony, you have other protection cords, is there any problem? Many of us have about 30. They generally wear down, but... So we'll close by chanting the refuges together, and you see the English here, but we'll just be chanting the Pali. So just as well as you can, it's not so hard when you see it written here. We'll take the refuges together. So just take a moment, take a few breaths, feeling your heart. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi hearts and minds be filled with loving presence. May these lives be awakened. May we touch peace and joy. And may this awakening ripple out. May all beings discover the truth of their Buddha nature. May all beings be free. Namaste. Well, I really want to honor you and your presence. It's quite beautiful to feel the quality here as you did the ceremony. We only do it once a year here. We chant the refuges, you know, each time at the deepening practice class, and we might do it more here. So you might hang on to the sheets, and we'll see how it fits in, because it's a beautiful way of coming home to our practice. And if you want to explore it in your daily practice, to take a few minutes at the beginning before sitting and doing this reflection, you'll find really wakes it up.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.